From URL Media, I'm Mitra Kalita.
And I'm Sarah Lomax, and this is Twice as Good. Today, we're discussing the unfolding crisis in Haiti with the founder of the Haitian Times, Gary Pierre-Pierre. Gary founded the newsroom 25 years ago and has kept an unflinching eye on Haitian politics, culture, and the diaspora. The Haitian Times is one of 32 independent newsrooms we support here at URL Media. Gary, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Sarah and Mitra.
Absolutely. So I just want to kick it off, Gary, with a question about how are you doing with, you know, the emotional and mental toll that this crisis in Haiti must be taking on you and, you know, your family and the people that you're close to, given your deep connection with Haiti?
Well, I think the emotion that I've been feeling, you know, during the moment of grief, you go through all these steps of emotions and feelings. But the one that I'm having now is anger. I'm angry because this was foretold. For the last, you know, 25 years, I've been writing about this, that we have to really turn the page, do things differently. We need to stop. And no one listens because they know it all.
Gary, I've been seeing you on CNN, NPR, a number of mainstream news outlets. What is it over the last few weeks that has caused this mainstream attention in the crisis in Haiti?
So I think what has happened in the last few weeks that got the mainstream media's attention is the fact that the prime minister basically was forced out of the country. He couldn't return because when he left to broker the deal, to finalize the deal with Kenya to send the police officers to Haiti to help stabilize the country. He was unable to return because the gangs had overran the airport, parts and controlled parts of the airport at some point. And then I guess, you know, a change of government is a big news peg for mainstream media. And they just went all in on it.
I'm curious, Gary, what is life like in Haiti right now? You know, what do you have family there? When was the last time you were there? Like, what is the day-to-day existence like for Haitians?
Well, it's pure hell. I have one niece and her two sons who live there. One day, a couple of weeks ago, she called me and she said, look, uncle, I've been running for like months now. I'm going from place to places and just shooting. She sent me WhatsApp video audios with, you could hear the gunshots, just like as if you were in a war zone. She left that place. Then she went another place. Same thing. And I told her, what do you want? Do you need money? She said, there's nothing I can do with money because I can't go out to get any food. And, you know, this is kind of funny because this is the first time you asked a Haitian person if you need money. And they said, no, because people always want money. And she said, it's not going to do anything right now because I can't. And she said, you know, one day maybe, you know, my phone will ring. It won't be me. It'll be my son because I'm dead. It bothers me because I'm like, okay, so I know all these people and my niece is living in under these conditions. And it's unfortunate. This is the reality of people who they've done nothing. These people didn't do anything. They did absolutely nothing. Just being, they are caught up in an extremely hellish situation. And it pains me. This is the other emotion that I, you know, a lot of anger, a lot of anxiety in terms of watching this and being in the middle of it and reporting it very clinically. And it's tough because people are dealing in a very bad situation. When I look at the photos of staff members, it's just, you want to cry because the country, it's a beautiful country. I tell people that all the time. It is absolutely beautiful. But watching those photos, it looks like something out of a war zone.
I want to ask you, Gary, as we keep hearing about these gangs that are overrunning the government or overtaking society, I wanted to see if you could give us more context and understanding of, like, who exactly are these gangs and how are they allowed to or able to run so authoritatively across the country? That's one. And then the second is the flip side of that. Like, what does Haitian peace and productivity look like? And what is the pathway to get there?
Wow. And you see how long do we have? No, seriously, these are great questions, but I'll try to be as concise as possible. If you look at the gangs as they're constituted now in Haiti, I would say they started in earnest, I would say 1995, six, when Jean-Bertrand Aristide was deposed by the military, Haitian military, in cahoots with the elite, got booted to the United States, spent a couple of years here. When he came back, he felt that if he had his own protectors, he wouldn't have had this coup. So he disbanded the army and he took street kids from the rough neighborhoods and he created neighborhood associations, if you will, that morphed into gangs. And the idea was always, and he armed them. So they began as tools of the political class and the business class. Like whenever there's some problem, then they'll hire these guys to go sow some trouble, burn down businesses of their opponents or rivals. And then what has happened now, what we're seeing now, they decided, okay, I have the guns. Why do I need a middleman? So now nobody has control over them and they have the guns. And so they're running rampant. But the reason, you know, there's a lot to say, but one thing, the gangs were created by Haitian society. The inequality in Haiti forced these gangs. And because they had no options. It's a caste system. I've written about this. Your surname is this. This is what you end up doing. You were born in a certain family. There's nothing for you. It is insidious in a way that there's no mobility unless you go to grift and corruption. And you know that's not the way you run a country, a society. So what does Haitian society look like? Ideally, what that looked like. I mean, I have my point of view. I think we Haitian Americans and Canadians have a big, major role to play in it. We need to stop being purveyors of remittances, try to be investors in the country and find partners. Now, before that can happen, this is where we need the help of the United States, help provide the environment, help reinforce the rule of law, and then let us come and help. You know, it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be quick, but I see that this as a 25 to 50 year program before you can have a just society. The country is not poor. The distribution of wealth is poor. You know, we love the culture. We love Haiti, but Haiti just doesn't love us back because those people who control Haiti, the gangsters. We talk about gangs in the street, but the politicians, they're the biggest gangsters, illegal gangsters. They call themselves legal bandits. They have a term for that.
This is a question for you. Is it the worst that it's ever been now? Or
Yes, ever. In my lifetime, absolutely.
Is there help coming from some countries in Africa for like peacekeeping or?
Well, I was not too enamored with that plan. You need to support the Haitian police. Let them take the fight to the gangs. Support them so they can win. Because what you do when you come out of that, you have a population. They become heroes in the story. You need heroes, and they could be that hero. When you bring the foreigners, and it's always foreigners who did it. And so then what happens next? You have to build the morale, the capacity of the police force to deal. And they can right away if given the proper arms. You know, Haiti is under arms embargo. Arms and ammunition are flowing to the country and ended up in the hands of the gangs. We just reported that.
Where are those guns coming from that are getting to the gangs?
DeSantis wants to patrol the waters for boat people, for refugees. He needs to patrol those boats who are leaving Miami, going to Haiti, because that's where they're coming from.
So who in Miami is incentivized to arm the gangs and the warlords in Haiti?
Some Haitian Americans. Who support the gangs because they see the gangs as some sort of a Robin Hood. You know, at first, though, the gangs were going after the wealthy and the elite, but they've all fled by now. So what's left is the poorest of the poor, those who just have no way out. So these folks in Miami are supporting it. And then you have arms dealers. This has been going on for years, by the way.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden, really, we have a problem. Well, yeah, a country doesn't manufacture guns and is awash in guns. Something has to be done about it. You know, United States has the fourth largest embassy in Port-au-Prince in the world.
Oh, wow.
It's huge. So I'm saying all that to say they have all the agencies are represented there. And so they know what's going on.
So for people who aren't familiar, just tell us how we got here, and then maybe we could get to where we're at right now that's getting you a lot of national news attention, which we'll get to in a moment as well.
To be quite honest, we have to start at maybe January 3rd, 1804. It was 2 days after Haiti's independence. This was not supposed to be a country. It was supposed to be made into a pariah state by the United States and France, which ruled Haiti with the most brutal form of slavery imaginable. Not as if, you know, slavery is something nice to begin with, but the one in Haiti was particularly harsh. The reason for that is that Haiti, it was rich, all sort of crops, cotton, tobacco, and you just go on and on. It had it in abundance, and France wanted to get as much out of it as possible. And so the Haitians rebelled, and France was a superpower of the time, and they made sure that, along with the United States, which had slavery not too far from its borders, this was a menace to society, to white world. And they had, Haiti had to be made into a lesson. And it is, and we're still undergoing that. So what has happened, Haiti after independence was isolated. The United States didn't recognize it as a country until 1865, after the Civil War. It had no trading partners. Its only trading partner was supposed to be Great Britain. Then America and Great Britain, you know, they coalesce around the danger that faced America, and Great Britain said, you know what, you're right. Because the relationship with those two countries, France and England, they were at war with each other. And there were a lot of proxy wars. So that's why when the U.S. was fighting for its independence, France came to the rescue. So Britain came to our rescue during our fight for independence, fighting against the French. We thought the idea is that Great Britain was going to be our European and world partner so the country could develop. Well, that never happened. And so the country never got a head start. There was a lot of infighting. It was total isolation. Haiti missed the Industrial Revolution. It was under world embargo. And so we never really learned how to govern ourselves, to be quite honest, because it was from one crisis after another. It continues to the day. And so at this point, why don't we just press the reset button and start anew?
I think one of the things that you didn't touch on was kind of really the bankrupting of Haiti, because Haiti had to actually pay France back for, I guess, the cost of the revolution and the cost that they incurred. And it really bankrupted the country, and it's never been able to even economically kind of get a reset, because, you know, imagine you have to pay your enslavers back because you throw off the shackles of slavery. I mean, that is about as twisted and as diabolical as it comes. So can you talk a little bit about the reparations that really, I think, should come from France?
After independence, as you mentioned, Sarah, Haiti had to pay the equivalent of billions of dollars today to France. And it really bankrupted the economy. It never really, like I said earlier, never really got a chance to be a country because it had no resource, no financing. And it was because, you know, France, I think it was by design. They just wanted to make these Black people pay dearly for having the temerity of calling themselves and then being free. And so you were going to pay for it come hell or high water. And today you see American officials, policymakers trying to act as if they don't understand what's going on. They know very well what's going on. Citibank was another company that was involved. It robbed Haiti blind, along with France. The Eiffel Tower, the Versailles Palace were all built with Haiti money. The New York Times traced all of that. They spoke and interviewed people, heirs of these families who are still alive today. And none of them knew absolutely nothing about this. Haitian history is not taught in French schools. They don't know anything. The French don't know anything about what they did to Haiti. And so that's really where we need to start educating French people about what their government did to a country that, you know, one president, former president called, you know what, whole country. And so if you loot a place and you starve them, what do you think is going to happen? And in many ways, Haiti is held up as a example of Black people can't rule themselves, okay? Well, that's not true. Why is it that when the Haitians leave Haiti, they do well? But in Haiti, they can't because the system is set up. And so it's a free-for-all. There are no rules that are followed in Haiti. Anything goes. A lot of people make money in that system. You know, I have the whole poverty, the USAID aid network that needs places like Haiti so they can function. And so Haiti just provides that, you know, that aid, which doesn't develop a country.
Gary, I wanted to pivot to the journalism the Haitian Times has been doing. I think you're among the members of our network where the journalism sometimes committed by outlets outside of the country is closest to truth that we're going to get, right? Because of the conditions on the ground. Tell us how you're reporting on the crisis, what some of your methods are, and then very importantly, how can we all support the work of the Haitian Times?
We've become sort of like the place where people said, well, if there's a story that's being shared on WhatsApp, some people will say, wait a minute, let's wait until we hear what the Haitian Times has to say on this. So basically, we've been pushing back against a lot of misinformation. As you know, in a situation like that, there's a lot of misinformation and disinformation that's prevailing. Support, you know, think about a small outlet covering a war and where everyone on the staff is affected. Those of us in the U.S., we have families. That story that I just told you is not unique to me or to, you know, the staff. And we maintain objectivity or whatever journalistic standards, it takes a personal toll on us. And so we are growing the staff. And so we really want to make sure that this is an important story. It's not just because it affects us personally. We're the Haitian Times. We're found to tell the story of Haiti and Haitians. And so we got to tell that story. We got to tell it not only in Haiti, but here.
I think we got to summarize, Gary, but I've said this to you personally for years. I think in terms of post-colonial narratives and covering the way the world is, there's no better than the Haitian Times. So I just really, my hat's off to you for that.
You know, I've been in this fight for, like I said, 25 years, and this is the first time I see that I have allies with me. This feels really good. It's a bad moment, but we have more support now because it's always been, well, we've always dealt with bad things. And so now I'm not walking alone.
This is Twice as Good. For independent news from our 32 Black and Brown outlets, visit our website, url-media.com. You can also watch the video version of this podcast by going to our YouTube channel. Subscribe for future episodes, and we'll see you next time. Thanks.